Hey there, and welcome to the We Move podcast. Today, we're continuing our exploration of what we're calling metaphysical culture. So, beyond physical, what do you learn and what do you start to feel and think after you've done physical practices, whatever kind of movement you choose, be it sport or a more somatic practice? It definitely, in our eyes, puts you on a different plane of thinking about what's going on. And today we speak to Rick Cooper, and he's a high performance coach and a leadership inspirational speaker. I use inspirational over motivational because I believe in inspiration more than motivation coming externally. And he said towards the end of this podcast, it's really important to create and nurture a culture that cultivates connection over competition. Now, this is from a guy who was a high-level rugby player, a strongman, you know, very involved in that masculine energy of competition. And when he talks about this idea of connection over competition, it becomes quite interesting. And that's really what we're listening to, and how you get to that place of connection over competition, because competition can be misunderstood. It can be, as Yami Tikkanen said, it can be the greatest gift to raise the levels of human potential. And it's a real celebration of each person, what they've done. And it's like a laboratory competition. Or it can be seen the other way, which is you do anything to win. And that doesn't always further the pursuit or humankind. So Rick's journey was a rugby player, found that had an interesting childhood, I guess. I guess as we all do, we all have experiences from there. But that sent him into rugby. And from rugby, he then broke his back playing at a high level. And when you break your back, well, not all the time, but he was told that he wouldn't walk again. What happens when you're told you can't walk again? Because that's a big deal. And that's something I want to explore, because that's, and we will explore that in this podcast and other podcasts, because that's your right and your freedom to move taken away from you, which is in the macro sense. That's what's happening in the moment, maybe. So we talk about that. We talk about this idea of sport can be toxic in the way that it's taught and cultivated. Self-worth, feeling aggressive or being aggressive because of feeling threatened. We talk about outlets to heal, and really where Rick is now as part of his kind of toolbox. And he's a big advocate of creating a toolbox that you can take out into the world with all these different practices and methodologies and modalities, so you can navigate the experiences you have around us. And he talks about shadow work, and Chris and I, for those of you who've followed other podcasts, we're big advocates of shadow work. I think it's a very, very important piece of the puzzle to understand why you are the way you are. And when that doesn't serve you, you can upgrade that little bit of operating system, refile those memories so they no longer create a negative charge or a fizzing connection. And you can find fulfillment and flow in your life. Be present in your being. All of those words and phrases that sound a little bit trite, but when you experience them, it makes a lot of sense. It brings a lot of peace. And I think it unlocks the door to potential. the way you start there, I believe, is you develop a physical practice, or you cultivate one within yourself, whether that's a walk that turns into a run, that turns into a challenge, which turns into an unavoidable part of your day. It just is that way. So we talked to Rick about those things. Great conversation. I met Rick in the sea, the cold sea in Brighton. And whilst we come from different sporting backgrounds, the water, the cold water, is a real connector. And we connected through that. We've had a few conversations over the last couple of years. And it was now that we decided to record this podcast. It's a really good one. It explores shadow work. It explores resilience. It explores ways to move forward and ideas to bring a deeper sense of peace and a more natural connection with ourselves, which unlocks our potential. So enjoy. Thank you for listening. If you like what we do, we have this... if you like what we do and you fancy supporting us, you could buy us a coffee. There is a link on our app, and coffee is KO-FI, where you can buy us what it would be, a virtual coffee, which keeps us fueled and going to create these podcasts, just get all the editing done. We absolutely thank you for your support, for those who have and for those who haven't and just listen. Do share the podcasts. I think the underlying thing is, for me, that getting into the understanding our past can help us create our future, as opposed to direct our future. And that's why we talk a lot about shadow work and physical practices, because they do go hand in hand. You need to experience, bring up these emotions and move them on, move them through the body. So really, I think that is, I think it's super cool. It can be really tough. It's not for the faint-hearted. You have to be at the right place at the right time. But if you begin that step, then that's where you get. Lots of love to you all. Peace from Chris and I. And let us know what you think. Rick Cooper, men's high performance coach. Welcome to the We Move podcast.
Thank you for having me, lads. do you know what I realised today was, I looked in my journal and it's 2 years ago next month where I wrote down that I would love to be on a We Move podcast. The first time I think I ever met you, James, was a sea swim.
It was with Rich.
You came with Rich.
Yeah.
And we got talking and I remember coming back and writing in my journal a goal was to be on a We Move podcast. And I was like, wow, the power of manifestation. It's taken 2 years. I didn't think, and I'm going to get into this. My self-limiting belief was I wasn't good enough to come on this podcast back then. And 2 years on, when you get outside, out of your own way, and it was like, wow, the power of when you get out, you let the universe open up for you. And I'm actually on it. And I've been buzzing all today, to be honest, to share the space with you guys.
Well, I think it would have probably been sooner had we remembered to send you a message. So, so I think it's a little bit of the universe, a little bit of manifestation. We could have expedited it if we were we go in fits and starts. We're on a rich vein of recording podcasts at the moment. So it's like everyone that we've wanted to speak to and haven't, and you're one of those. Because yeah, we met in the sea with Rich Hussaini, who we've also done a podcast with. It was interesting hearing you two chat then. Was that 2 years ago today then?
Yeah, 2 years ago, March.
2 years ago, March. I remember that being really nice in the sea.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not like it is at the moment, but we are. Oh, we're February. But I remember hearing you two talk, and it's always, I always pick up on this, and I don't know whether Chris picks up on it, but the world that we've kind of gone into, it's like, often we say, it's like we're in like this world of alphas and we're always slightly detached, because it's really interesting to be in, like, be in the sea with you and just size wise. And we'll get into this and this idea of leading. You are a former rugby player who, you know, you broke your back, didn't you?
Yeah.
Which is, that's led on to, I've got a few people I want to speak to about breaking their backs, because that's a whopping thing. That definitely changes where you go in what you do. But it was just like always being there. I just remember bobbing, we were treading water. We were quite far out, and just like listening to you two talk. And I was like, I'm kind of so out of my depth here, but I'm not. Like literally I was like bobbing away, and you were talking about, I think you were talking about, some force plate, you know, he's like, I don't want to be, you know, just measuring people on a force plate or something. And 2 years on, what is a force plate?
A force plate.
Force plate. You were talking about like measuring people's strength or something.
Oh God, it's just the strength conditioning world. Everything's just about measurement, you know. Like, and I was saying to Rich how it's never about like we talk about human movement and human experience. But as soon as you get into that sporting world, you can't just be allowed to be free. You can't allow to be expressive. Everything has to be measured. So it's, you know, like, it's like force plate for everything, you know, like your whether it's S&C stuff, your velocity of your force, the velocity of your power, weight training has a dictation on the velocity of speed you can go. And I was saying to Rich, like, we lose the freedom of expression, because we're constantly measuring. And that does something to the unconscious mind, in that you start like a sport because the gift and the talent, and then because it wants to make you, well, you want to be professional, so you buy into what that brings, the science behind it all. And the science tells you that for you to be better on the pitch, you have to be better in the gym. And for you to be better in the gym, we have to be able to measure all these things. And I think somewhere along that line, that freedom of expression and joy and fun gets diluted. So I was kind of saying to Rich that on that journey. So go on, Chris.
I was going to say, it's so interesting, is it? Because it, like, you could get all the top measurements in the world, but if you've just split up with your wife the morning before the game... Despite the fact your metrics are showing that you're in the best shape of your life, you're probably not going to be playing too well.
It's like, exactly.
It's just one side, isn't it? It's just quantitative data, as opposed to like you're saying, as opposed to also taking into account the qualitative data of, you know, one's actual being and state of presence, state of mind.
Yeah, 100%. I totally agree with that, and I think that's where I was falling out of, that was falling out of love with sort of the strength conditioning world. And we've talked about this, James, a lot around like physicality and using your body and what you use it for. And I messaged you last week, James, and Chris, to involve you in this. It's the best podcast, I think, in my opinion, you guys have done. I'm a massive fan of the We Move. It's the one you two just released the other week. I found you really interesting, Chris, on that, where you are now and the mindset behind it all. Where I completely resonated, where it was like, I said to James last week, you've got to a point now where it doesn't matter how fast you do anything. It doesn't matter about the competition with yourself anymore or anyone else. It's just, you just train because you know you want to be useful in life. And I think when that happens, you change the whole narrative of your own being in the world.
Mm.
I found that podcast really interesting. I think I've listened to it twice. But it's a good conversation.
Yeah, it was a good, that was the shadow work. Atlas Balls and shadow work.
Mm.
Which is, I think that idea of, we'll get into kind of your history in a sec, but I think that idea of being useful is just when someone says, why are you doing something? You just want to be useful. Like when you're not useful, you just feel like a lemon in the corner. Like you can't do anything, can you?
And that reminds me of the Erwan podcast, actually, like sort of Erwan McCaw. He must have been one of the very first podcasts we did, like episode 5 or 6, talking about, you know, actually being useful and at the moment
strong
of crises,
to be useful. I think he was. That was
at the moment that you're actually needed, you can actually perform. And his whole philosophy with MovNat or MoveNat.
Yeah, it's being ready, isn't it? It's like that. Exploring a state of readiness, which is a phrase from Tony Molina, another guy that we spent time with in the States. So back to you, Rick.
Yep.
What was your, obviously rugby player, but what was your journey to being a rugby player and the level you're at? Because you're pretty high level.
Yeah. And no one's ever asked me that. What's the journey to rugby? That's a really good question. My journey to rugby was free food. Quite a fat kid, And I remember getting the invite to go to the local rugby club, and you got lunch after. And I just remember thinking, oh, yes, like, well, I'll go to this kind of thing. I think I was about 10 years old. I just remember that was the overriding thing, was the free food. But I kind of went, and I just enjoyed the physical side of it. At that time, it was like, yes, like, this is quite good, feeling like you can express yourself physically and I guess fight in a way, you know. I mean, obviously you're not fighting, but being able to tackle someone and not be told off was awesome, because I grew up with a sister. And whenever you fight with boys, I always felt like I was going to get told off. So to be able to be shown something where I could physically, you know, get involved and not be told off was like, yes, and I get food. So that was like the introduction to it. And I just, as it went on, I just found out I was good at it. And I think I was good at it from 11, 12 years old, as like a pinnacle, because I was quite angry. And I look back now and it was like, wow, like, it was anger that fueled me. It was anger that made me good, because I loved physical confrontation. At 11, 12 years old, I was quite an aggressive player already. And at 12 years old, I remember, we're going back probably, 40 this year? So yeah, we're going back to 28 years. I remember when Jason Leonard, old England prop, bit of a legend, came to our club. We played his boyhood team, Barking. And he came down and watched. And I had some news that morning that we thought my nana died. And I'd gone there. My mum had gone off to London to see if my nana was okay. My dad took me to rugby. My dad was our coach. And he came in the change room and I was crying. And he shouted out in front of everybody, "You pussy, sort yourself out. We've got a rugby game. Like, don't let the team down." And I'm like, oh my God, I'm like 11 years old, 12 years old. And he walks out. And that was it. All this just turned to anger. Like, I was just like roaring inside. I'd been belittled. And we came on the pitch, and I was just an angry boy. It's the first fight I'd had on the pitch at like 11, 12 with this team, just pure anger. But I played an absolute stormer. And Jason Leonard had come up to my dad after and was like, "Can you, any chance we could get this boy, your son, to come to Barking?" Because they were a top team at the time. And he wanted me to travel sort of 20 miles from our Essex home. So that was the first part. And then as time went on, you know, I was like, this is all I want to do. I want to be a professional rugby player. And it wasn't even professional at the time. So I used to get laughed at school on careers day because I just gave no effort or thought to education. I was like, right, I'll go to school and I'll just play rugby. Like, that's it. I'll tick the boxes and I'll play on a Sunday and get recognised. At 16, I went to Saracens. So I got in their 21 squad. I was the youngest, because you couldn't go in until you was like 18, but they recognised something in me. So they let me play for 21. So I was kind of like a boy in this like nearly man's world. And to be honest, it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. We had a coach, a man who was a massive bully. And I remember him, I was dropping a ball once and he called me out in front of everybody in the training pitch. Blast, called me a C. He told me I was embarrassment if I drop another ball to go back in the changing rooms. And you can imagine being 16 and these other guys at 19, 20, like a professional rugby club. Like, it was hard. It was the first, probably where I started to lose my expression of playing, because now it was about fear rather than fun. And at 18, I got more involved. So what they used to have was an associate professional contract. So you were kind of professional, but not. And things started to go a bit south from there. So form was going badly. I was having a lot of personal troubles at home, where my mum and dad were on the verge of divorce. So this was playing my mind. I started to get injured a lot. And everyone thought I had tight hamstrings. So I was having 50 acupuncture needles 3 times a week from my neck down to my heels to try and release what they thought was tight hamstrings and lower back. And then what happened was one morning I just woke up and I couldn't feel my legs. Petrified. Got a hospital appointment and it showed that I had a complete clean crack straight through my spine between the L4 and L5 and both discs squashed. Like, I think the surgeon said they were so squashed that the inner juice of our discs was on the verge of popping out of the disc, is what he said. I don't know if that's true or not, but this is what the scan showed. And that was it. Rugby career over. Cut away from it all. I had to go back to home. And in them 3 months, we got made homeless. My mum, we got repossessed from our home. I was in and out of a wheelchair. Disability in jobs wasn't what it was now. So I basically was smacking back 20 diclofenics a day and a pack of ibuprofen to try and kill the pain, to try and walk, to get to interviews, because my mum, you know, my mum and my sister needed, we needed rent to pay for a flat. So I was living on a floor in the flat or at friend's house and things like that, and got a job, had surgery 18 months later, and they put the spine sort of back together again, manipulate the discs back into the L4 and L5 holes. And the surgeon said to me 6 weeks later, after asking the question, "So when am I going to play rugby again? Because I'm still like, this is all I'm going to do with my life." And he says, "Boy, you're not even going to stack shelves at Tesco's in your lifetime." It was that serious. And it was just like, oh, wow. Like, the whole world comes caving in. And then you're overruled with anger. I'm 20, 21. This is not going to be my life. And then you've got, oh my God, what am I going to do now? Like, who's going to want me? Who's going to employ me? I don't even want to work in somewhere like an office. So it's desperation mixed of all the other stuff that's going on in your life. It's just like this volcano going on inside of what you're going to do, who you are now, where you belong. And so it's really, really dark time. Basically I kind of made a deal with myself that I was going to teach myself to walk again properly. And then I was like, okay, what can I do? Well, I can swim. So I used to walk up at 4 o'clock in the morning, walk past two swimming pools to the furthest one, which is about 10 kilometers away, and I'd swim. That turned into, okay, I'll swim 30 lengths before I leave. That turned into, okay, lifeguard could save me. I'm going to go all out. I'm not going to stop swimming until I pass out, because there's someone here that can actually dive in and get me out. Let me see how far I can take my body now. So that happened on a couple of occasions. And then I was like, okay, now I've got myself physically ready. That was like a couple of years. I was like, I need to do something with my life, because I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm in an office job that pays me £600 a month. I've got no prospects. I'm driving a really crappy car that still has four gears and a choke that people are breaking into and leaving at the top of the road because it's that bad. And I'm like, something needs to change. So I went to a careers office and was like, listen, this is my qualifications. What can I do? And they were like, well, you can have a go at trying to get in the military or the emergency services or become a personal trainer. So I was like, you know about my back, right? And they're like, yeah, well, you know, it's your application. You can choose whether you want to put that on there or not. And I was like, do you know what? I had big voids of being wanted, big voids of having any significance in the world, big voids in being relevant. And I was like, do you know what? I'm going for that firefighter one. Everyone loves a firefighter. Women love a firefighter. Teamwork again. So I was like, I'm going for it. Like, I'll get all my needs met then. So it's a big process. Like they say in London at the time, I think we got told that for every one position, there's something like 500 applicants is what we got told. So I was like, okay, what can I control about this? Because once we do the maths and English tests, you have a physical. So I was like, I can control the physical. So the physical then was a 9.6 level bleep test. But that was minimal. So my maths obviously is like 30 people, 30 vacancies on average times 500. What's going to make me stand out? Well, that bleep test. I need to get as high up that as I possibly can. So I felt like I'd lost time. Your dream's gone. Your rugby career's gone. You're like, okay, control what you can control then, because you don't know when it's going to be taken away from you again. What can I do with this body? So I went to a field, which was probably about 800 meters round. And I used to run the 800 as fast as I could. And then I'd sprint 100, jog 50. And I kept that up. And I was like, right, that's it. Five bin bags, two jumpers, two tracksuit bottoms. How far can I push this body to get in? Right, what's the deal? Same deal. You don't stop, Ricky, until you crawl off of this field or you are found. You've pushed so hard, you've passed out. So that's what I did. I found myself in hospital three times. Once I'd lost all body function. So I woke up with... basically, like, I'd feces myself and wet myself. Another time with like blood all over my face where I must have passed out, and another hit the floor. And there's another time with blood like in my ears, out of my nose, where I just pushed and pushed. But to me, that was like, yes, satisfaction. Like, I'll show you what this body can do, world, like, kind of thing. Still angry. And got to the fire brigade and outran the bleep test. Basically,
outran the bleep test.
Yeah, so we got to level 20, Chris.
Amazing.
It just said it was complete. So I was like, happy days. Like, they apparently, whether it's true or not, I'm sure there must have been loads of people who have done it, you know, like athletes, Olympians, whatever else. They said at the time, at that present time, that they only knew that David Beckham had done it, they'd been registered. So I was like, yes, claim to fame. Woo! I'm the second person to have outrun the bleep test, Brian Bex. But it was just one of them things where it was like, it was competition. I was like, this is a controllable, it's competition. I've had my body taken away from me once before, so I'm not having it again. What can I do? And that's where it led to. I got into the fire service, enjoyed 10 years as a firefighter in London. Loved it. Had temporary promotion, so, you know, was officer in charge on a couple of incidents for Islington Fire Station. Brilliant. Went back to play rugby. So the same year I got in the fire service, so 2005, I went back to play 5 years after I broke my back to my local club. And I went on to break everything else for 5 years. So from 25 to 30 playing rugby, I basically did my jaw's metal. So broke my jaw. So I've got 3 plates all through my jaw. My nose is metal because I couldn't breathe properly. So I had to put plates in the top of my nose to open the canals up. I've had 5 broken hands, saying like 5 or 6 dislocated fingers, 2 broken ankles, 2 shoulders taken off twice. It was an eventful kind of time, but it was awesome to be part of something because they were in lower leagues. And I came back where I still had a very professional attitude. As far as I was concerned, rugby to me was about, you know, elevating to a standard. So I kind of brought that back with me. The way I conducted myself after games, before games, stand behind to train harder. And I think that just echoed through. And, you know, no man does anything themselves. As much as the ego is like, yeah, we're self-made, that's rubbish. Everyone's got a team around them. I think I collided with a brilliant director of rugby who came in with an awesome vision, and another coach, Mickey, who was ex-military. And I think the three of us just helped cultivate a culture and the next generation of players to come through and keep lifting that club. You know, I was captain for a couple of seasons and we got into national leagues, and it's still there now with a great crop of players that I've had for the last 10 years who have just continued to elevate. And I just like to think that I was a small little part of that start of that projection for the club. But yeah, that led to 30, and then gave up rugby because of breakages. Found CrossFit, did CrossFit for about a year, enjoyed a bit of success in that. That then found boxing because I was a very angry person inside. CrossFit wasn't hitting the boxes. I was like, I still got pent up aggression. I can't get this out in training. I want to actually kind of hurt another human being. Well, not human being. It was a man thing. I felt like I needed to exert a dominance in a male environment. There's a lot of self-limiting beliefs about my worth of myself. Being bullied as a kid by my father and my uncle, coming into Saracens and having a coach who just belittled me in front of older boys or older men. And it was just a theme that I'd carried in my head. And I look back now, it's like, wow, there was so much anger. And then I boxed and I had a fight for the ABA and really hurt a guy. It was a real moment where I was like, what am I doing? Like, this guy might be self-employed and he might have kids and he can't go to work. I've just done this damage to him. So that was the end of the boxing part. And I got into powerlifting. And it was the first time it was kind of like me against me rather than me against the world. And did quite well without knowing it. And I got an invite to be part of the Great Britain team. So that was 6 years ago this year. The invite came through, but I was dead. I was dead inside. I was like, I should be really excited. I get to actually represent my country, but I don't feel anything. Like, I don't know what's going on. I don't feel anything inside of me. So I didn't go. And I did send the 300 kilogram deadlift video to the surgeon and he didn't reply. And then we moved, and that was the biggest change, but everything started to happen. Was we moved from Essex to Sussex, and I didn't know who I was. I had no friends. I quit the fire service 6 years ago. I was a new dad. And I just didn't know who I was. It was like this big, big guy that has big reputation for sport or look, you know, my mohawk haircut, diamond earrings, this tan. Because I'd done bodybuilding amongst that for a couple of years. It's just everything you knew about yourself and what everyone knew about you had gone. You go into a gym in Sussex and no one cares about you. You know, like, no one says hello. No one wants to congratulate you for who you are. Your ego is not being stroked. And it was a dark 12 months. Out of everything, that was the closest it came to not wanting to be on the planet. But it also led me to what, to where I am now. And I'm so grateful that it turned out to be the best move ever from what at the time I thought was the worst. This de-identification stage and cleanse. Like I read Matthew McConaughey in Green Lights recently said that every man needs to escape what he knows to find out what he knows. And when I read that, I was like, oh, wow, that was me. That was me 6 years ago this year. Was it was the darkest 12 months of my life, but it's turned to be the resurrection of who I truly am. That I'm actually not, I'm not an angry man. I'm a really calm, measured, loving, and dare I say it, like I found out I'm actually intelligent, which I always thought I wasn't, I guess. You know, like things that came from school when you think you're stupid, like standing on a table at 7 years old, but being put on a table by a teacher, putting my head through a noose and being told to shout out "duh" in front of the rest of the class because I asked for some help on a maths question. You know, them things stick with you and you create limiting beliefs in yourself, don't you? And that's what happened through my adult life. And then as soon as we moved, I found out I loved self-development. I loved shadow work. I loved meditation. I loved diving deeper and deeper and deeper into myself to see the whys. And it was amazing. And that's what led to me to now, the life coaching, NLP coaching, shadow work facilitator, all this sort of stuff and helping other men. Ultimately, I say it's to become a high performer because who doesn't want to live life to the best of their ability? When people say, oh, high performance, is it sport, Rick? It's like, no. Like I'm helping men to live life in fulfillment with purpose, like every day. And it's like, who doesn't want to be the best they can be in their personal professional life?
What happened over that 12-month period? Like what, you know, because you turn up in Sussex and you have this 12 months, the darkest period of your life, as you said, or as I heard you say. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of like the story almost jumps. And it's like, oh, I realized actually I wasn't angry and I'm intelligent and there's a gentleness to me and I want to support other people. Like, but like what happens in the 12 months that helps you understand that or see that or feel it or realize it?
Do you know what, Chris? I left the fire brigade and Essex. And when we came here, it was like, I don't know who I am. And I started to go to London to work on the underground night work. So I was only sleeping about 3 hours a day. Just couldn't get on with nights. And it was like sleep deprivation was leading to some really, really dark thoughts coupled with like, who the F am I? Like, who am I anymore? Like I'm a dad, I'm a husband, but what does that mean to me now? Like I thought a dad had to be a big macho man that like led the way and just did like got busy sacrificing everything to make sure they supplied for the child, and he had to be a big masculine macho man for especially when you've got a son like to look up to, and all that was disappearing because it was disappearing for me because all them environments I put myself in were no longer there. I just didn't like who I was becoming. There's a couple of incidences with Clay where like he'd stroke the dog and I deliberately put my leg over the dog because he was annoying him. And I remember thinking, oh, if I just take my leg away, he'll fall to the floor and realize like, okay, I've had enough. And I remember doing that and he fell down and hit his lip and he cut his lip open. And I was like, oh my God, like, who have I become? Like, I'm so tired and I hate myself so much. Who have I become? And I remember getting in the car and Emma said, my wife said, oh, he needs to sleep. What's happened? I was like, nothing. Like, I'll take him out for a sleep. And I got in the car and I drove to Devil's Dyke and Chris broke down, like literally in the car. Broke down so hard I couldn't talk, like snot everywhere, spit everywhere, just sobbing and sobbing and sobbing at the top of Devil's Dyke with him asleep in the back of the car, just thinking, oh my God, how do I get out of this? What do I need to do? And God, just brought the lump to my throat then. By chance I quit the job that night and I was like, I'm gonna go and try and build a personal training business again in Sussex. And through that I met a hypnotherapist and she got me involved with hypno, and that was where it started. We started to understand like the showreel, basically. We went all the way back through my timeline, where my beliefs had come from. If I could talk to certain people in that timeline, like what would I say? What have they left me with? Why do I express the way I express? And that was the turner, the hypnotherapy. as soon as I was able to talk about things that I'd buried and buried and never spoke to anyone about before in my life, that was where it all started to change.
When you were a kid, did you realize you were angry? Like, were Definitely. You that clear about it, or was it just
you
that's,
guys
that's were, Rick?
Kind of yeah, thing. It was almost like it's like two people, James. You know, rugby day, like I was really well known for being a very aggressive rugby player. So you'd have the school bullies, where I was never a cool kid, and I was never like a, you know, I put inverted commas, like a geeky kid. I got on with everyone, and everyone knew that I was always happy and like quite a soft person. But even the school bullies were like, oh, like they'll play for the local other team rugby team. And they'd be like, we won't bully him kind of thing. Like, we won't pick on him. And when we played their team, it was almost like it was Crazy Rick. You know, like, yeah, as a person, he is not playing rugby, which is quite gentle and smiles and, you know, and just generally laid back. And then you've got Rugby Rick that was just angry and loud. So, no, I never knew. And we had this chat the other night, actually, about computer games. It was like all my friends used to stay indoors and play the Sega Mega Drive and Master System. And I was like, I never wanted to be indoors. I didn't want to look at a screen and play computer games. Mm. All I ever wanted to do was stand outside. And I used to throw a rugby ball in the air all the time on my own, just bored. And my dad wouldn't come out and play with me a lot of the time, or I'd kick a football against the wall playing rebounds. And I don't know how relevant that is to now, where I'm just like, the outdoors always played quite a big part. But I think because of the internal trauma that I experienced within the house, coupled with some bullying and some belittling from teachers and coaches, it was coming out as anger was the, like rugby was the release to my anger.
Mm.
Like, it's hard to watch it now. I'm not going to lie. The last game I've watched is the Rugby World Cup final. And it's quite a hard thing because Emma's a lead men's rugby coach for a college. She's quite involved. And I'm like, I kind of can't get it anymore. You know, like, I don't know a rugby player that hasn't got, I haven't met one yet, so I'm not generalising, but I haven't met one that doesn't have something inside them that wants to completely bash another man up. And where I am now is like, we need to address that. Like, you know, like, we've normalised this for like all of our lives, and I've got friends who still play or still is heavily involved. And I'm like, there's something in there that needs addressing in that timeline where there's a willingness to absolutely hurt someone. And then think it's all right that it's rugby, and afterwards it's okay because we can shake hands and be friends after.
Well, I think with any sports, like being at school, certainly, so we're all the same age, and I remember being at school. I wonder what it was that teachers at that time, because then you start to track back, kind of knowing what we know now, and like we've all done shadow work, etc. And you go, when you think about the maths teacher. I mean, I had run-ins with my maths teacher who would just pick on people. And you're like, then you plop back to where they were. And I often think like the First and Second World War just has so much to do with all the trauma that was passed down to then, you know, because it was just suppressed. And then it came out in these weird ways. Like, who gets a kid to stand on a desk? You're like, I'd make the teacher stand on a desk. You know, I'd almost want retribution for the teacher that did it. It's like, all right, just it's a weird, weird thing. But how at school, like rugby, I was at a soccer school, soccer and tennis. So it was different, but it wasn't. You could do anything. Like if you were good at those sports, you just celebrated for, you know, you take someone's head off. If you take the whole opposition's head off every Saturday, you could pretty much do anything. So you walk around going, this is good, but it's the underlying thing is you just kind of want to be pretty mellow. Like they celebrate a strange thing. They celebrate this idea of performance, but underlying, like, what's driving that, which I think is, yeah, like you say, I've been watching, weirdly, since our last conversation, Rick, I was watching, we talked about the Johnny Wilkinson podcast on the High Performance Podcast, which is a great episode. And I was listening to, is it Sean Wayne?
Yes, that's an awesome podcast.
That is a really interesting podcast. And it kind of links straight into this because they asked him, they were like, where did you become this kind of great coach and leader? Like, what happened in your childhood? And he said, I have no good memory about childhood.
Yeah.
And you're like, fuck. How? I mean, it's super sad. It's clearly then made him a very good coach, and he's like almost like a dad to everyone, like the dad he never had, in a way. Worth listening to that one. But it's so strange how sport, I think, yeah, it's almost becomes toxic, because you celebrate this slight you celebrate the outcome of a slight dysfunction.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I could talk about that for hours, and then I just had nothing to say after it. But you see all these people that we celebrate, and I often think of, you know, climbers or whatever, or anyone that they've all gone through some event that people then want to emulate them. And you're like, do you really want to emulate that person and what they've had to go through to get to that place? Which I think is why Johnny Wilkinson's podcast is so good on that, how he talks about him.
Yeah.
Where he is now. And it sounds like you're in a very similar place, in like you can look back, and because I only know you as, I mean, you are physically, you're big, you know, you're tall, and your rugby physique rather than climber physique or triathlon physique or, you know, soccer physique. So you have a presence, but you're super gentle. You know, so it's kind of, that's how you are. But I remember we were at Barney's doing that WOD, and I was watching your power output on the rowing machine, and I was like, they're not even numbers. That, like, it, I think he's broken it, because the numbers were too high. I was like, this is ridiculous. We had to, like, delay.
Little did you know that he would pass himself out on a swimming pool or on a field.
But it's,
being on a rower was no problems.
But you then get people looking up to you, don't you? Which that's what you said the other week. You and at the rugby club when you went back, it's obviously people then look up to you, and you can change culture. But that then leads me on to this idea of understanding the responsibility that you had, like after breaking your back and coming back and working with the rugby team, but kind of knowingly, unknowingly, or unknowingly, knowingly?
Unknowingly, I guess. I remember as a kid being with my boyhood club and being like, God, wouldn't it be cool if you could have a stadium built around this, and we could be in the national leagues kind of thing. And I think, like, when I went back, probably that little inner child was still in me, where it was almost like a second chance. You know, you felt like I'd had stuff taken away from me, like my body taken away from me, and now I was back. And it was like, I just wanted to be the best. But in my head, by me being my best meant that I expected everybody else to have my standards. And that became quite frustrating. So when I went back, like, you know, rugby clubs, there's a certain mindset that runs through the veins of a rugby club. And I'm sure it's like it in many sports, that when you've got a club, there's a certain way of the people that run from the top down have a way of looking at things or thinking. And it just felt like when I went back, I found it extremely frustrating. Like some of the lads as well, I was just like, just keep, you know, let's just strive to be more. Let's strive to take this somewhere. And then the next generation after a year, 18 months were coming through, and they were buying into this. And I think it kind of fell apart for me, and I let myself down a little bit, because I let a lot of it rub my ego, and I did things off the pitch that weren't particularly things that a leader does. So it was like, you be a person on the pitch and off the pitch, your role is far more important in nurturing and cultivating a culture and the example you set to what's on the pitch. And I let myself down in that area as time was going on, I think, because I let the adulation and the ego really just marry together and create a downfall for myself. But it wasn't until you step away, like you said, James, you just touched on it there, that there's a toxic way of doing things. And I think that's from a place of not being self-aware of what you're doing, that you do things for the sake of doing them, and you're not particularly aware of the influence you're having. And as what we know now is you can take actions that cultivate a healthy culture. Like when we worked out last year at Barney's, I just did me, but it was pretty awesome to see that the person next to me and behind me would push as well, because I pushed and I'm like, oh, this is awesome. Like, this is a healthy way of doing things. And I haven't got to go to the edge and pass out. I just go as hard as I can, as long as I can talk and still spur someone else on as well, rather than sort of go off and gallivant on my own and try and let the ego lead this. I don't have to go all out to pass out. I'll just go as hard as I want to go. And part of that process is being able to still look to the next to me like, come on, we got this. You got this. Let's go. And that's a healthier self-awareness, rather than thinking like you're out on your own and everyone can follow. Well, no, we're in this together. It's about collaboration, connection, not competition. If that makes sense. I know we talked about this last week, but I generally believe that the opposite to competition is connection. That when we in competition with ourselves or anyone else, the worst part about it is one, we are not in true connection with the other people, whether it's our team or who we're playing against. What makes it more sadder is that we're completely disconnected from ourselves. And it's only yesterday when I was thinking about this podcast and I was like, Jesus, like, we're bred, completely conditioned and bred to be in constant competition and doing mode. And I think it's because yesterday I was on Insta and I saw a meme that said, be better than you were yesterday. And I was like, what the hell is that about? Like, just that sound alone, and so many people dine out on that one as if it's like, yeah, it doesn't matter about the world, it's about you, so be better than you were yesterday. Well, the central nervous system doesn't understand the difference in words. The stimuli is exactly the same. Whether you're competing against who you were yesterday or other people, the stimulation is exactly the same to the brain. Why not just live? Like, be the best you can be right now in this minute for today. Don't worry about yesterday. Don't worry about tomorrow. You're not competing. Just connect with you right now and be the best you want to be now. That's true connection. That's present. And we talk about presence. That's presence. But that's, you can't have presence. You can't have competition when you've got presence, because you're connected. Whether that makes as much sense out loud as it does in my head, no idea. But when I saw that yesterday, it was like, God, like, we celebrate and find ways to condition ourselves to compete. And it was like, Christ, what if we could just find ways to create memes and environments that cultivated presence and connection? Like, how different could the world be then?
James and I were having a conversation about this the other day. Actually, we were talking about it was actually as I was doing part of my shadow work and kind of looking at my extreme behavior at time, and it's somewhat similar to you, of like, you know, take a pride in me out to outrun someone or to outtrain someone, or certainly in a physical sense, if I wanted to, I knew that I could go on longer than anyone else, type thing. And actually it was from a place of what I came to realize was that extreme behavior was from a place of wanting to feel better about myself. Like, if I could outcompete someone, then I was better. Then, you know, then I'd proven my worth to someone outside of me. So I could be valued rather than just for being me. I could be valued for what I could bring to the table. It's like, oh, there's Chris, he can run further, or he can run faster, or whatever. And so it kind of got me thinking on the lines of these terms of like, oh, I want to be better. And just coming from that place of saying, I want to be better, there's an implication that you're not good enough.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be better than I am. It's like, well, that means I'm not valuing who I am now, and I'm saying that I'm not good enough already. And James and I were talking about this, and we were talking about the words, changing the words better for develop. You know, like, I want to develop myself. So you're not negging on yourself, basically. You're just saying, well, this is where I am, and I want to develop that skill. It's not to say that where I am is not good enough. It's just to say that, well, I want to, you know, develop the skill of painting or photography or running or whatever else it is, or, you know, communication. There's a difference between the words develop and better. One implies that where you are good enough, and the other implies where you are is not good enough. And like you said, there's, you know, there's just a constant literature and ramming down the throats of, you know, be better, do better, just do it. You know, all these types of slogans, like the whole world has been seemingly built on making you feel like shit and making you feel like where you are is not good enough. And, you know, so to come back to your, come back to what you're saying about presence, you know, presence, accepting who you are in that moment as being good enough, you know, and good enough for everyone in the world, for yourself, for, you know, for your parents, for your family, for your wife, your husband, whatever, for all beings. Yeah. Doesn't mean you have to be where you are today. Doesn't mean where you can be, you can't be somewhere different tomorrow, but in that moment, that's why for me, the shadow work has been tremendous. And, you know, I had another breakthrough last night within my shadow work, and it's like, they just keep coming and I can kind of keep linking back to go, fucking hell, that's why I was acting the way that I did when I was eight. Like, what? Like, you know, I held on to the story of acting in a certain way when I was, you know, when I was eight or nine, or like in my case on a football field, and it had been labeled as this and that had been demonized. And actually it was just because I wasn't being allowed to, you know, express in a certain way. And that was the only way that I could, you know, somewhat similar to your story, and having that realization, and then also having a realization from being my teenage years and a certain, I acted in a certain way at a certain event. And I could kind of see how it was basically because I was so ashamed in that moment. I basically upped the ante and outplayed the shame. Like, well, okay, yeah, I feel like this, but if I go even further, then it totally like disguises that, you know. But it's taken me like, you know, 25 years or 26 years to work out that that's what I did. And there was such a relief in that. I was like, fuck. Now I can like very rapidly connect all the dots to similar types of behavior throughout my entire life of like, oh yeah, holy shit, that was the same. That was the same. That was, you know, I created a model to make myself feel safe in those moments. And because I knew that it would distract from that, I could just keep playing out that model over and over and over and over again, which obviously was not to my benefit, but it was a way to make me feel safe.
Yeah.
I truly believe actually that there's never a really any malintent in actions in anyone. It's people act in a way that makes them feel safe. And I mean, maybe it's slightly controversial to say it, but it's like, I think even in moments of aggression, I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head. I would say, like, you know, with rugby, you know, want to get on the pitch and hurt someone because I don't feel good enough. You know, it's not, you know, there's not a malintent in that. It's just a way to make oneself feel safe, or, you know, the root of it. There may be some malintent in wanting to hurt someone, but the root of why you want to do that, I think it's really relieving, because I think within that moment, it's impossible to be angry with anyone. And I think it's possible to then come to a place of compassion for everyone, and to understand that everyone has had some type of trauma, and some people's traumas are way worse than others. But, you know, 10-year-old self doesn't recognize being beaten senseless by your father or being made to stand up on a desk.
Yeah. I think that's interesting, Chris, when you said that, like, traumas, that some are worse than others. And then Rick, you were saying that the central nervous system doesn't recognize a lion coming at you, or whether it's a lion or something less life shortening than a lion.
Like a quadruple coffee. Like, yeah. The adrenaline and the stress is exactly the same.
So almost all, it's like all trauma is the same. Like they're not graded. Because when things become graded, I was thinking about this with, I was having a conversation with someone yesterday, and what they'd been through, the experiences that they'd had, and things that they'd seen, they fought in a couple of the, you know, they did some tours of Afghan and Iraq and all of that stuff. You're like, wow, what they've seen. And then you think about like stuff that, you know, has happened to me, and you're like, wow, I've got nothing to, like, mine's nothing. Theirs is, you know, and then you start to play this game, and then you suppress it even more. And if we could just like level the playing field, remove the idea of good or bad. And like you were saying, Chris, it's, then you can just start to have compassion and go, yeah. There's almost a consequence of running at someone very hard, very fast. If you're bigger than them, the smaller person will probably break a bit. And if it's two very big people running at each other full pelt, you're both going to break. The consequences is the same. And then the shadow work is just, it just seems to be, I think it's, that's the next stage in, maybe the next stage and the only stage, and should be flipped around for people to develop themselves or perform, or like, it's a real gift giving people a clear, it's like having a fresh notebook.
There seems to be a lot of personal development, which is on like step four of the ladder, and conveniently missing step one, two, and three, which to me is shadow work and inner child work, which I would actually say is pretty much one and the same thing, really, because what, in my opinion, one develops out of the other, or it's kind of in, you can't do one without the other. But it's I was listening to a podcast the other day, and someone sort of said, yeah, we're talking about the shadow work, and they're saying, you know, it's really hard and it's quite traumatic. And I was like, are you kidding me? It's the fucking greatest thing I've ever done in my life. Like, this is fucking amazing. Like, yeah, it's like rough, you know, at times, of course. But, you know, just the sheer relief that you get from it is just like, oh my God, thank God I wasn't going crazy. You know, like... And so I think, you know, I observe, and now I just think of myself being in my semi-early 30s and being in a bookstore, and, you know, yep, I'll have that self-help book, and I'll pick that one, I'll do this, and I'll try that. And it's, you know, it's like, because you're just kind of groping around in the dark, you know, at that time, you know, I hadn't seen any therapists or didn't know anyone else that was kind of trying to deal with anything of consequence, you know, or anything of, you know, of their self, and this just wasn't really kind of, it wasn't there in plain view. Like, here is the big section that you have to go through first before you're allowed to get to the self-help section. You know, yeah. It's like, you know, do not pass this section.
It's foundational, isn't it?
Yeah, I see lots of personal development that it's just like, it's just pointless, in my opinion, unless you're willing to do these couple of things first. Then it's just like, it's a waste of time. And actually, maybe it's not pointless, because, you know, maybe that is one's journey, and that was my journey, you know, to have to go round the houses to come back to the beginning. But yeah, Rick, so I'm really interested to hear. So you said you went to the hypnotherapist, and you started to decode a lot of this stuff. But where does, you know, so I'm always conscious of someone listening to the podcast, and because of that, what we were just saying about not really knowing where to begin. So if someone was listening to the podcast and they heard that you went to a hypnotherapist and you started to, you know, decode these beliefs and work out why things were going the way they were, what was the continual process through that? You know, you came to shadow work, you came to, you know, NLP, you know, what was the process? I imagine it wasn't just 12 months of hypnotherapist and then it's like, great, I'm done.
Yeah, it was we had the hypnotherapy, and obviously that just, it literally just lit up my brain, because obviously you learn that, like you said, Chris, I can't agree with you more. The hypnotherapy sort of got me interested in, okay, wow, like all this stuff's come from the shadow and the inner child, and every feeling and thought I've had has come because of this and this. So for me, I had no knowledge. It's like you just said, you're going to self-development world and you're scratching around in the dark, grabbing every book, because one, you think that's what you're meant to have, and two, everyone's like book club on social media. Like, these, some of the books are brilliant, you know, like Atomic Habits and stuff like that. And I picked up all the ones that everyone said, and I'd get a third of the way in and I just feel, this has got no relevance for me. Like, it might be great for everybody else and everyone sort of screams about it, but I couldn't find the relevance. So it was a case of, right, okay, what resources do I have to speak to people that I trust who are involved in this to help direct me? Because I want to find out more. So I went to my hypnotherapist, but like, where can I go from here, kind of thing? Like, what do I need to read? Because I really, you know, I want to explore more beyond our relationship. And she directed me to a couple of books. The Alchemist was one, Robin Sharma, the monk who sold his Ferrari. So I got into a couple of books. For me specifically, it was about letting go of materialistic thoughts about myself and what the world was like, and helping me to understand how to be more present with what I have and chasing. And then I got involved in a charity called A Band of Brothers, where you become a mentor for young men between 16 and 21. But that involves a rites of passage weekend. I don't know if you guys have done this, but as soon as I got into it, it was like I wanted to immediately feel like I wanted to help other people. Like immediately it was like, I really want to help others, because now I've got a brief understanding of myself. How can I use what I've learned to teach someone else? So kind of thing. And I went on that, and that was my first experience of shadow work. We had a weekend away in nature, and we were in tents for the weekend in October, detached from the outside world. And we did shadow work with the young lads and each of us, like participant men. And that's when I found shadow work. And while I was there, I was like, right, okay, you're learning now that you're making these new connections. Let me not touch base with that shadow work guy. And I got involved with him. And like you said, Chris, it was a release. Like it was the best thing ever. Yeah, it's traumatic and it's bloody exhausting. But the release work is just unreal. It's energizing. It's freeing. It's almost like you're like, you've got permit. It's almost like someone says, here you go. Here's permission to start all over again, kind of thing. But use these experiences to harness and nurture what it is, who you actually want to be in the world now. Because don't let them think this is a clean slate, because you couldn't have had all that to help project where you want to go. So now we're going to use it as big tools in your toolbox to take this into the world. And I'm probably coming off sort of course with that a little bit, but I can only talk from where I came from. And that was where mine got directed. If anyone is listening to this and be like, oh, okay, like, where do we go from here? Is just try and reach out to a trusted source. I mean, we live in a technological age. Like, we've got access to everybody for free with social media. And I'm always like, if someone resonates with you, unless they're a complete dick and you reach out and they're like, no, I'm not giving you anything, all of us would give something for free. All of us want to help someone get somewhere. And I'm like, we live in a really privileged age where we can practically reach out to anybody we feel a resonation with that would happily give us a little bit of advice to help us get on our way.
Rick, my experience of doing all this work is as a single guy. And I say that because, you know, whatever time of the day I decide to do, you know, to focus that time, I'm also aware that afterwards, you know, I have no responsibilities to anyone else. How is it for you doing this type of work and then kind of opening the door to the room where you've been doing it and you have a five-year-old kid and a wife and, you know, responsibilities outside of yourself? What's that experience like?
Listen, I'm not going to bullshit. It's hard. It is hard, especially in the current time, because you can either make a journey where you decompress, but it's very hard to take a one step to open a door and close it and have a decompression time when you do have other people that really demand. That's a strong word. You have a role that you want to fulfill. Like, I want to be a father. I want to be a husband. They are two things that are at the top of my value list. And to walk back into that environment and not fully decompress is hard. Like, there's no denying it. And for me, it's about looking where the space is. So I know I have to get up at 5 for me to go through them practices, so that when I step out that door, when they're up at 7 o'clock, I have had the decompression that I've done. I've tended to myself. Like, it isn't like I'm some sort of martyr where some people are like, oh, 5 a.m. club, Rick, are you soldier? But it's like, no, it's not that. Like, I want to show up as the best version of myself. And I understand that I need to go to bed at 9 o'clock at night to be able to do that, because I want to get up at 5. Like, I want to go for a walk at 5 o'clock, and I want to come back and do my meditation and address what's coming up for me. And I want a journal to get this all out, because when I come out and I've got the role of dad, of husband, of, you know, facilitator, as coach, everyone of them people deserve the best of me. And it's my responsibility to use the 24 hours that supplies that. And I need the best of me. You know, like, everyone thinks we're selfish when we do this work. Like, my family don't get it. Like, I don't talk to my, I literally, the only person I talk to is my mum. I don't talk to my, I haven't spoken to my sister for 6 years, my dad for 10, and they don't get it. Like, my mum cannot get it. And I'm, she still thinks that if you take care of yourself, you're a selfish fucker. And I'm like, you can't drum that into someone's head, where it's like, it's selfish to give half yourself to people that want your attention. Now, what's not selfish is getting up to look after yourself, to make sure that the people you interact with get the very best of you. Like, what's not selfish is you waking up and then going to bed going, yes, I was my best self today. I'm so proud of myself. And I think we externalize so much, you know, even in self-development world, give everyone else, you've got to make sure you give everyone the best of you. What about me? I want the best for me, you know. And even in this world, in the SD world, we still concentrate on the externalization of everything. You know, we still put the emphasis on someone else, of what we are for them, rather than, what does it take for you to be the best for you? What does self-love look like for you? Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, for me, the practice for me is, I mean, God, I try to put it out there as best I can. The get up at 5, I do a dynamic meditation that involves breath work, mind into body, some chanting, generally leads on to a little bit of a workout. I go out in the garden and I have the cold hose shower every morning to try and get the cold water stuff in. For me, we all know the science behind it. The other part for me is it's that resilience. Like, I've been there when life gives you crap. Like, when you lose your legs sort of temporarily, you know that life's going to give you something. So if you don't make deliberate steps to do things you really don't like I hate the cold. You know, when James said earlier about we were in the sea having deep conversation, all I cared about was trying not show the other guys I was shivering like shit under the water and I just wanted to run out. So like, for me, it's making a step of, okay, how can I win early in my day? That's the cold water. I'm like, I don't like it, but it makes me concentrate on my breath. I have to be present. it gains momentum. So like I talked this morning on Instagram about pick the discomfort, you know, whether it's make the phone call you don't want to make, but just lean into it. Like, mine's the cold water, because I know if I get that done first thing in the morning, any other task in the day, I know I can face. Like, I've built resilience up, as well as building my own well-being. You know, it's picking the simple tasks that don't take time up away from the family. Like, we all have a shower in the morning. Brilliant. Make it cold. Like, you want to make a difference? Excellent. Go to bed half hour early. Get up half an hour earlier. Give yourself, buy yourself pockets of space to take care of you. And yeah, I was having this chat this morning, actually, where you like really overcomplicate and overstimulate an event or a stress or a challenge in our head of what it looks like to probably be our best self. And really, it isn't really that difficult. I know you guys talked to me last time that the workouts you guys are doing like 20 minutes to 40 minutes long. And I'm exactly the same as you guys. I used to spend like an hour or 2 hours working out. And like every day, I don't think I work out for more than 30 minutes now. Because I know that's what makes me feel bloody alive and so good about myself. Mm. Yeah. But I had something I was going to say to you guys about 15 minutes ago. I can't remember what it was. There's something about the full, I was going to say something with full circle. It was to do with the shadow work.
I find that it's interesting to hear about what you do in the morning and then integrating it with something physical. Because I think people understand the physical side of something. It's like, oh, I'm going to go for a run. But if you put something before it, like the shadow work and the journaling, almost you buy yourself the decompression. Is that because it's like, oh, Rick goes for a run every morning, or you know, whatever you do, it's deemed okay. But I think the physical is really important, so interesting to hear you talk about the dynamic meditation and how it's not just sitting still. There's movement in there to start to bring up and move out and integrate thoughts and emotions.
You know what, James, I've learned that I felt like I could, it was hard to resonate with me a year ago, 2 years ago. Social media's pretty helped me with this. For something I've really disliked, it really has helped me to look like, actually, do you know what? It's hard to resonate with you, Rick. You look like this action taker that gets out of bed, that just does shit. And then when I found the dynamic meditation, which brings me back to like develop or being better than we were yesterday. When I do dynamic meditation, I have no attachment. I don't attach myself that after this, I'm going to work out. After this, I'm going to run. After this, I'm going to take massive action. It allows me to be in a place of presence on, okay, this dynamic meditation is brilliant. What's going to come up? How can I detach from my thoughts, get into my body and see what's coming up? And at the end of it, if I'm like, do you know what? I don't need to go for the run. I don't need to pick up the sandbag. I don't need to put myself through the kettlebell workout right now because I've found what's just come up for me. And I feel, and it could be that like, I feel alive. I feel great. Don't need to push myself into the ground of that workout and however long it takes. Mm. But some days it is like that. And I guess what I've tried to do is cultivate a massive presence and understanding what my body needs rather than what my mind wants it to do, which is a big, big difference.
Yeah.
And I think it is easy to look on, and you know, especially men, we're brought up to be action takers, drivers, warrior psyche all the time in its smallest to grandest forms, you know, of just do, go, 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 must, should kind of thing. And it is practicing that being, mm-hmm. You know, like when I found the dynamic meditation, I'm being rubbish with meditation, always have been. When I found the dynamic meditation, it was like, oh, wow, this is definitely a piece of me.
So how does the meditation go? Is it like shaking?
Yeah, look it up, Chris. So it's Osho, you know, Osho.
Yeah, it's the Osho. Yeah.
Oh, it's just incredible. Like I got taught it in December and it was like, God, I get to do breath work followed by like shouting and screaming and pretending I'm like an animal. And then bring that into chanting and then practice stillness and celebration with it. And it was like, oh my God, like I'm covered in sweat. I'm out of breath. I feel energized. And I've literally not thought about a single thing. And I've recognized any thought I did have, I've managed to let it escape because I've just literally concentrated on my body. And it just took a whole new level for me, Chris. And I altered it. Like rather than have 60 minutes, I'm able to manipulate it. So you could do, I generally do like 3 rounds of the Wim Hof breathing straight into sort of 5 or 10 minutes of maybe shouting or thinking I'm some sort of like leopard rolling around the floor or whatever it is. And then like 5 or 10 minutes of the chanting where you, I don't know if you've seen it, but you kind of like, you're in a star shape and you jump up and down and you chant at the same time. And it's just amazing. Like it really is something that really resonated with me. And it just got me sweaty and yeah, out of my head. And the amount of the journaling I've done off the back of it has been incredible of like what comes up for me. You get in stillness, you finish. And it's like, I've had the most profound journaling experiences off the back of that meditation.
Go on.
I was only gonna say some of the best like 20 minute morning workouts some days as well, where you're so clear, but you're so in tune with your body. So rather than be like, oh, I'm going to grab like a couple of 24 kilogram kettlebells and do 10 sets of 10 thrusters with press ups and burpees in between, you suddenly realize, do you know what? I think I'll just pick up a 32 and I'll just do 10 sets of 10 and I'll have a minute rest. And it's like, wow, I found some self-love and kindness for myself where I've come off script and just done what my body's just told me it needs.
So that's amazing, yeah, man. I was just going to say, I found the journaling to be like a phenomenal practice. Like I was saying, I've maybe messed around with a long time, but with no kind of commitment to it or discipline to it. And actually the shadow work for me has kind of given me that commitment to it. And it's been utterly fantastic. The Osho meditation I've done, I remember the first time I kind of was doing it, I was living with 3 other people and I'd go into my bedroom in an evening and do like 60 minute Osho meditation. And they came out like, what have you been up to? He's like, nothing. I prefer to see it, but I can totally see why it's, you know, why it would be amazing and would really suit some personalities over others. Mm. You know, a brilliant practice.
Yeah, it's very powerful. You can be somewhere where you're not conscious of being heard or what's around you.
Mm. And I suppose like from a, I suppose why it works so well with the journaling is that you're really going into your subconscious mind, aren't you? Like you're actively doing stuff to take yourself out of your mind. So then you have access, say coming out of the back of it, you immediately have access to the subconscious, which is then when it can pour out onto the journal pages.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's been awesome for me.
And so amazing also to hear how you've adapted it, because I would have been so rigid with the rules. No, it's 15 minutes of this, 15 minutes of that.
You know what, Chris? Old me definitely would have been exactly the same. It would have become like a pressure thing and a more of a chore rather than, I'd love to do it, because I would have been exactly the same. Like, it has to be an hour. Like, there's no leeway on this. This is the guidelines. This is how it must be. I think I'm just learning more and more now is like, there is no guidelines. We get to create everything, like everything. Mm. And I think the more we can surrender to the fact that we have the freedom to be just like that, that the more free in life becomes for us, the more we can actually be ourselves and be completely creative and expressive.
Yeah.
But yeah. Awesome, love it. I just remember what the full circle thing was as well now.
Go on.
It was the shadow work, and I was gonna say about when we talked about the inner child and the shadow and going back in time, and something that I learned more last month was always being like a soft, like we talked about, it was being like a softer guy and a softer boy. I always wanted connection. I loved cuddling. I'm like it now. You know this, James, when I'm in person, I always have to cuddle you with me. And like, you know, if I'm next to you, I've always got to like try and touch you with my elbow or something.
I'd call it a hug.
Sorry, we're men here. So.
Kiss a cuddle.
Yeah. But I remember when I was a kid, my uncle used to come around and get me headlocks and stuff. And I'd like half pass out and I couldn't fight back. And he'd say to my mum, oh, he's going to be gay, like kind of thing. He's too soft. And that riddled me for all of my adult life. And then I realized last month, this is a massive realization. Sorry, not last month, December, on men's retreat. I had a massive sense of fulfillment where it was a very tactile environment that we connected on a really, really deep level. And I can't obviously enclose the details. It ruins anyone's experiences that ever goes on the retreat. But we connected on such a deep level, everything, that there was contact all the time, whether you handshaked, whether you put your arm on each other's shoulder, whether you hugged, anything like that.
Cuddled.
But it really made me realize, oh my God, 20 years or 25 years, whatever it is, of this contact sport full of anger because of all this stuff as a kid, where I thought I've been led to believe, oh, I'm going to be a pussy or I am a pussy because I'm soft and gentle. And then I realized right now, men more than anything actually yearn for safe physical contact.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big realization for me, like back in December, where I was like, I feel generally completely filled up when you work with a group of men that you do have this connection with. And when I work individually, you hug, you have a proper handshake, and it's like, wow, I wasn't alone all this time. Mm. That we've all believed that we have to be something, and actually what we do yearn for is just complete safety in physical contact, and we all yearn to be expressive.
Yeah,
sorry guys, I just remembered it. I know it was like half an hour ago, but
no, brilliant.
Yeah, really, I think cool. It's really poignant, isn't it? Because I think I often joke, you just wanted a hug from your mum or dad, really. And you're just trying to return to that. And I think even the biggest guys or the seemingly most aggressive people, they're really gentle. It's like, it's a real superpower to have great strength. And it's a real superpower to feel safe enough that you don't have to express it as well.
Yeah.
So I get that. I think I always wonder how many men walk around angry, and like boys and like almost they're not allowed to express it. Or I know with our little boy, he's two, he's growing up, and seeing Luce, be with him, and it's so different. And like how I'll be with him, and if he's a bit wild, I'm just like, there's a stick, there's a tree, just go and you just like totally express it rather than quieten it down. It's like, open the door, there you go, there's the stick, there's the tree, just go and then give him a hug when he comes back in and go, that's all right. Like, we need to express it, but so often, and I guess that's what sport becomes for kids, isn't it? It's harnessed into we're just looking to be told that we're good and we're good enough and everything's okay. So you get on the rugby pitch and you do what's necessary to be told you have worth, which might just be totally taking that other kid out hard. But it just cements stuff down, doesn't it? Or score more goals, and then you're like, this is bullshit. Like, who cares about scoring a goal? It makes me think about your idea, or that idea of connection and competition and being on the pitch. Almost like it only works if everyone's on the pitch together. Like, the game only works. So if you, it's not really about competition. Like, you can only express your skills with someone on the other team.
Yeah.
And then it becomes like a really beautiful thing. Then everyone's just expressing themselves in the moment. And occasionally, the tackle will come off, or, you won't evade capture. But it can be a beautiful thing if it came from this place where everyone was like expressing and having connection with each other rather than total disconnection and just full impact.
Do you know what, James? It brings me back just to quickly touch on the same point, really. You said, I wonder how many men walk around with so much anger inside. And we do seem to supply sports with that. I don't know if a more poignant question is, how many men walk around with so much love and affection inside but don't have an opportunity to express it?
Mm. Or frightened to express it.
Yeah.
Yeah. For fear of judgment.
Exactly. Mm. Well, sport is our mainstream outlet for that aggression, and we celebrate it. But where do we celebrate the opportunity for men that walk around with so much love and expression inside, they're so scared to express it? It's almost like which one, or is it that any which one of those emotions is greater? Interesting, isn't it? That's an interesting narrative on both ends. Because if we look at men can attach to like sport, or like we say, men love to say, oh, there's a gym, it's my release. And I always go, release from what? Life. It's not the gym we should be going to release them. We need to, first of all, probably comes to your point, Chris, with how many steps self-development are down the ladder. Let's look at life so we're not escaping it, because you'll release and you've got to come back to it. So we tend to put the emphasis on release, like gyms. I've got to go to gym every night to release. We're spending so much time and projecting such a big vision on the release, which is in turn affecting our mental health, that maybe if someone else come along and say, okay, let's look what you're trying to escape.
Mm.
Where's the pain coming from for you to feel like you have to run away from it and have a release? Because if that release gets taken, like hence in COVID, I see loads of stuff where people say, oh, mental health because the gym's shut. Well, let's address what's really happening here, rather than looking at something that's completely unavailable and making that black void of your mental health and the attachment you have with a gym even greater, because we're trying to have a release from something that's going on.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But just the way my mind works of it all, it's just trying to change that point of perspective. Because I think we're great at curing a symptom rather than curing the cause.
Well, probably easier and more lucrative, or more straightforward.
Exactly.
And more lucrative.
Exactly.
Yeah. Repeat customers.
Yeah.
I mean, that is what the pharmaceutical industry is built on. Let's think we're curing them.
Yeah.
We'll give them a short-term release so they have to keep coming back to buy it.
Yeah. Let them think. Let them think we're looking after their actual their health.
Yeah, that word release is curious with like physical exercise, because for me personally, I often feel the physical aspect of it is more a kind of a check-in and calibration, like to know how I'm feeling.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, just to kind of check in with myself and like my is there a load of chatter going on in my head, rather than necessarily a release to escape from something. And I had a realization the other day, I was like, God, my life is exactly how I want it to be. And I've never felt like that before. And I was like, that's pretty cool, isn't it? Like, sure, it can
freaking amazing, mate.
it can develop more. But I was sitting there looking at my family and we were eating. I was like, fuck, this is cool. Like, it's exactly where I want to be. And I'm,
if only I had a green juice on the table, it'd be perfect.
Well, that's the development stuff. That's the development stuff. But I thought that was really, really cool. Because I've definitely felt like with when I spoke to you, Rick, I'd just done that 1,000 deadlift thing and then, you know, try it again with something else. But that was enough for me. I felt like I had such a, it was so big for me. It was just, it wiped everything clean. And like that recalibration, it was like, oh, cool. I can do that. Yeah. Rather than feeling a need to go out every day to do something. And like, it does change. I think when you understand, when you understand the fundamentals of it, you can then play with it. Like you play with the dynamic meditation. And I think Chris, I would say you do that in other ways, you know, you dip in to what you do. But I think when you start to understand how it actually feels, you're like, ah, as long as I do this, these are the bits that make me feel this. And I understand why I'm getting in a cold shower. Otherwise it's pretty miserable.
Yeah.
You know,
getting in the cold is awful. Yeah. Absolutely awful. But like, as we were saying, we all know the benefits of it, and you know, and it's a 2-minute process. That's what I think is hilarious about the cold now. It's like, I'll literally get in for about 60 seconds to 90 seconds now. I'm like, I don't need to get in for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I just don't.
Yeah.
Like 60-90 seconds is to go to exactly your point, James, of like you know, it's a conversation, Rick, that James and I often have with like these big physical pursuits that people do, and it's like, why are you doing it? Like, it would be it'd be stronger for you to stop in the middle of it than it would be to continue to go through it.
Yeah.
You know? Mm. Rather than just like kind of beasting yourself. I think that's what's been so nice about the Atlas Ball challenges, is kind of like doing them from a place of enjoyment, as opposed to, you know, trying to annihilate our bodies into submission.
Mm.
You know, pushing it to the extreme where it's just like, it's just painful. Like, it's just, you know, it's hard, but it's not painful as in like, you don't get up the next day and it's like, you can't move. And it's like, well, why have I done that? Like, I've completely ruined the next day because I can't actually move because I was too busy destroying my body the day before.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that then you stepped over the fine line.
You not find it, Chris? It's such a beautiful place to be in now.
Yeah, I love it. I really love it. You know, it's almost meditative for me in a sense. Like, I get up and it's like it's one of the first things I do in the morning. It makes me feel really great, and it's like 20 minutes. And like, you know, like you, like I would have spent hours, you know, racking out endless amounts of reps and sets, and actually just doing it for 20 minutes is like, makes me feel amazing, and I can kind of crack on with the rest of my day. And it's as much about doing it in the morning as it is about doing it. Like I don't really like training in the evening. Like, I didn't train this morning because I basically just didn't want to do the workout today because it's massive. But even that, I'm like, I just don't want to do it today. I'll do it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like, there's, you know, there's no judgment to it. It's like, I just, you know.
I would add in there, there's a caveat, because knowing you, if it needed to be done, you would do it. And maybe that's a part that it can be forgotten, or or ignored. It's like being prepared to do it. It's like, okay, when it needs to be done, you'll do it, rather than just like, oh, I didn't want to do it today or tomorrow. It's like, actually, when it needs to be done, you'll be there.
Yeah. And so I suppose there's peace in that process, and they're the amazing, like, side benefits, I believe, of doing all of this, the inner psychological work, where it's like, you know, you just free yourself up of self-judgment. Yeah, you know, it's just so relieving not to carry an Atlas ball of judgment on your shoulder all day.
Yeah.
You know, self-judgment, which, you know, I also would say, like, what we judge in others is what we're judging in ourselves. It's just nice not to have that.
Beautiful.
How do people find you, Rick, other than we'll put links and all that jazz?
So Instagram, Rick_Cooper. There's Facebook, just Rick Cooper. Website, www.rick-cooper.com. Yeah, that's where you can find me.
And then people can work with you, like, because that's also what you do.
One-to-one group. I'm just venturing into the corporate world now. So helping in the corporate world, coaching companies around communication, culture building, well-being. We've got a men's self-development weekend at the end of February, around wealth, abundance, self-awareness, finding, like, unique strengths and talents to project yourself into the world from a position of power rather than what you feel the world needs you to be. So we got them. And then obviously once lockdown's lifted, we will have the Wolfpack retreat again, which will be a men's retreat to really dive in and find our true identity as individuals, create a vision and come back in the world in a place of being rather than doing. So yeah, excited, really, really excited for this year.
Awesome, man.
Oh, on the podcast.
Mate.
Podcast will be out at the end of February. So yeah, the Rick Cooper Show will be out by the end of February. By the way, guys, I'm really grateful for you holding the space for today. Thank you very much.
Pleasure, loved it.
Yeah, really, really very much enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
Cool.
Right.
All right, dude. Peace.